Support for this public radio podcast comes from Acura, featuring the TL Type S with a 286-horsepower V6 and real-time traffic alerts. Learn more at Acura.com.
Coming up on Weekend America.
What can a union do for you?
This morning, a lady was talking to me about the union. Somebody came to her house on the door, and she started talking to them about the Lord. And she said, "You're not going to be here for me, but I know the Lord's going to be here for me."
A North Carolina slaughterhouse struggles with its labor force. I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Desiree Cooper. This weekend, you can reach across the web and touch someone.
We did a little pretend blood bonding on the chat one day. We both put a red pin on our fingers, and I touched my screen, and she touched her camera, and we consider ourselves best friends.
How much love can you share online? And we'll celebrate the muffling of winter.
Really, it was just so quiet. I had nothing but the sort of sound of my own thoughts, and they were really loud. And the wind, that's all that's going on.
Musician Bon Iver turns the silence of snow into his weekend soundtrack on Weekend America after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, welcome to The Weekend. I'm Bill Radke at North Carolina Public Radio.
And I'm Desiree Cooper in St. Paul, Minnesota. Thanks for listening to the show about what America's doing this weekend. When's the last time you got out to shake your groove thing? Well, in this hour, we'll go to Chicago, where, for some reason, for some women, there's nothing like a judgment-free dance party. What's your dancing style?
My dancing style is entirely chaotic.
My dancing style is ancient.
I would say my dancing style is a little bit hip-hop, a little bit 80s.
That wasn't a pretty time for dancing.
A lot of shoulders and hips.
Everything from being classically trained, you know, technique to just funking it up out on the dance floor, just whatever the beat moves me to do.
Ooh, my dance style is maybe a slow jam. That's it.
Slow jam. Des, on my first date with my wife, she busted out a move called the Metro, in which you pretend to hold a subway strap with a newspaper under your other arm, and you sway back and forth, and I was completely hooked.
Wow. I wish I had been there for that magical moment. Those voices come from New York, San Francisco, and Las Vegas.
Well, as I said, I am at North Carolina Public Radio this weekend, WUNC. I'm at their Durham studios in the American Tobacco Historic District. Tobacco is a big part of the history of the Tar Heel State, home of Lucky Strike and Bull Durham. Here are two more facts about North Carolina. This state is the second largest producer of hogs, behind only Iowa, and it has the second lowest rate of unionized workers. And those two realities are at the heart of one of America's most bitter union battles. It's happening at the largest hog processing plant in the world in the small town of Tar Heel, where Smithfield and the United Food Commercial Workers have spent 15 years fighting over the right to represent the plant's 5,500 workers. The dispute has featured intimidation, drawn-out court cases, and even protests against Smithfield's spokesperson, celebrity chef Paula Deen. Here's North Carolina Public Radio's Dave DeWitt with the story.
The number 17,000 is written in bright blue marker on a whiteboard on the wall of the Smithfield processing plant. That's the goal, 17,000 hogs the workers here will disassemble during the morning shift. Each day, the workers here on the cut floor steal a glance at that wall, looking for the number. If it's a big one, like today, the hogs will come down the line at a furious pace. 6 days a week, for more than 7 hours a day, workers will stand in the same place, slicing and deboning the hogs with knives as long as their arms. So this Saturday, you may be barbecuing. At Smithfield's Tar Heel factory, over 2,000 people are disassembling your meat.
One of the most highly skilled jobs, pulling the loins, is where your pork chops come from.
The work is hard and dangerous, and the employee turnover rate is understandably high. Smithfield hires 5,000 workers each year at a starting salary of $9.20 an hour, or about $21,000 a year. Most quit in the first 90 days. Those that make it longer hope for a promotion away from the most dangerous jobs. That's what happened to Nora Gamaro. After starting on the cut floor, she was promoted to the laundry and now assembles boxes. She grew up in Chile and came to the plant 8 years ago from New Jersey after her husband passed away. She admits her job is tough, but she has little use for a union.
My husband, he worked for many years in New Jersey in the glass company. He was a machine operator there, and they have a union. And my husband always said to me, they don't do nothing because he saw many people with problems and they never help nothing. So they only take the check or the money from us. That's what I heard from my husband, you know.
Employees talk often about a union. Barbara Lee hears it when she takes her break. She came to the plant 13 years ago after the Black & Decker plant down the road closed. Her first job was trimming the fat off of tenderloins. Now she makes $13 an hour as a line leader.
This morning, a lady was talking to me about the union. Somebody came to her house on the dough, and she started talking to them about the Lord. And she said, you're not going to be here for me, but I know the Lord going to be here for me.
Barbara and Nora both receive full medical benefits and make more money than they could anywhere else in the area. This year, for the first time, they got the Martin Luther King holiday off. Barbara says Smithfield takes good care of its employees.
Oh, we're about ready to tell Smithfield that it's got to do right by the workers, that it's got to allow the workers to organize, that it's got to allow the workers to bring justice into their lives and into their community and into their families. Somebody give a praise to God for that.
It's standing room only at the First Baptist Church in Fayetteville on Martin Luther King Day. The United Food and Commercial Workers and local churches have organized a rally for Smithfield workers. They wear bright yellow T-shirts and sit in the first few pews. Some hold their children as they stand and sing along with the choir. These employees describe a company that is abusive and indifferent to the health of the workers. When the choir finishes, some of them tell stories of losing fingers and other painful injuries. The only thing nearly all employees can agree upon is that things have gotten better at Smithfield. Gone are the days when the company's private police force dragged union sympathizers from the plant. Gene Bruskin is the lead organizer for the UFCW's campaign against Smithfield. He credits the courage of the workers for the slight improvements, but cautions that the fight is far from over.
Only with a written contract that guarantees that these and other improvements will be made will there ever be any justice.
Any agreement between Smithfield and the union is still a long way off. Neither side is willing to accept the other's conditions for a union vote. In October, Smithfield filed a lawsuit against the union under the RICO statutes used by prosecutors to fight organized crime. That has Reverend Graylin Hagler a little agitated.
What they're trying to say is that anybody who stands upon the gospel and says, thus saith the Lord, and Smithfield, you're not abiding by the Lord, somehow we are guilty of organized crime. You know, if that is an organized crime to speak for justice, then I got to be guilty of participating in organized crime, because we're going to organize with people of justice all across this country. And
the only certainty is that the 15-year-old fight to unionize the Smithfield hog processing plant will continue in this poor and forgotten corner of North Carolina. I'm Dave DeWitt for Weekend America.
From North Carolina to South Carolina, where all eyes are on this weekend's Democratic primary, I'm Desiree Cooper. South Carolina's large African-American population is on the hot seat this weekend, especially the African-American women. Will they vote their race and come out for Senator Barack Obama, or are they going to support their gender and vote for Senator Hillary Clinton? Now, many say they'll vote for whoever speaks to them on the issues, but the stakes are high, and so for many black women who largely vote Democratic, it's not just a question of which issues are more important, but which identity is more important, race or gender. Racism is like chronic pain. It's always there, and it always hurts. But there are many respites that I feel from racism, like when I'm around the dinner table or just with my friends. That's when I'm free of race, just as. Not so with gender. Even at home, I'm supposed to know where the socks are because I'm the woman. For years, I did most of the childcare, the housework. Unlike racism, sexism followed me home. The famous abolitionist Frederick Douglass was also an early feminist, and he once observed that talking about equal rights for animals would be less controversial than talking about women's rights. Well, now there's a woman poised to take the highest office in the land. How does a black woman turn her back on that?
Yes, and that's the dilemma and why I have had to sit on the fence for a long time.
That's Jackie Washington, an African-American feminist. We met 20 years ago on the board of a Detroit Area Women's Foundation. And she remembers when Congresswoman Shirley Chisholm ran for president in 1972.
I walked around the city of Detroit trying to place placards. I was ridiculed. I mean, the males just thought that was the funniest thing. I knew that it was going to be very, very difficult to ever get a woman in a position where she would be seen as a viable candidate for the presidency.
That's one reason she was so excited about the Clinton campaign.
Having a woman as president who understands the issues of reproductive choice, of issues of equal pay for equal work, who understand about the glass ceiling, who understand about child care and early childhood education. All of those things are issues that women in the feminist movement have fought for, and most of the women that have run for office, not all, but the majority of them, those are top issues for them.
Is that a top issue for you as opposed to issues of strictly race?
It is very hard for me to separate that. I wish it were that easy.
Of course, not all black women feel as torn as Jackie does.
I really relate more on race than I do on gender. And I think that's the issue for me.
That's my friend, Detroit attorney Nicole Lamb-Hale. She never questioned her loyalties.
When I walk into a room, I really believe that they see my race before they see my gender. I mean, obviously they're entwined and, you know, they'll get to my gender. But I just really think that the reason that I see it as a clear choice to support Barack Obama, you know, he's just a wonderful candidate who's African-American and who is eminently qualified to lead the country.
Is this about the moment for an African-American man to be president, or is this about Obama for you?
It's about the moment for a man to be an African-American president. The icing on the cake for me is that, you know, I know the man and I know what kind of person he is.
Mm-hmm.
So that makes it even better for me.
Not for a majority of the black females in Congress. Of those who've stated a preference, most are supporting Clinton. Eleanor Holmes Norton said it best. She's the delegate for Washington, D.C. And she told CNN, it was hard to make a decision when everything that you have fought for all of your life comes true. All in one election. But for African-American women, this dream come true is clouded by the pressure to pick the candidate who can most effectively break that presidential barrier. More than at any other time in history, they feel they have to make this vote count.
Of course, this weekend, the only voting going on is a Democratic primary in South Carolina. The Republicans will vote Tuesday in the Florida primary. Democrats will be waiting that one out because you may have heard the Democratic National Committee stripped Florida of its delegates as punishment for the state moving up its primary without permission from the DNC. You can go to our website, weekendamerica.org, and there you will find our ongoing coverage of both parties' election races.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week.
Your life may be an open book, but how would you feel about it being a nonstop movie? Coming up on Weekend America.
Thank you.
From American Public Media, welcome to The Weekend. I'm Bill Radke, this week at North Carolina Public Radio.
And in St. Paul, Minnesota, I'm Desiree Cooper. Now we meet a 29-year-old singer-songwriter in Phoenix, Arizona, Jody Gannant. Now, she had big plans this weekend to go to L.A., but she's sick in bed. We spent the day yesterday looking at her. She was under the cover, surfing online, guzzling liquids. She had her hoodie up over her head. Now, we don't have an inside line to Jody's life. She's been webcasting herself 24 hours a day. She says it's all about the pursuit of her musical career, but we wondered what it's like for Jody and her friends to live their lives as an open book. Renee Gattel has the story.
Jody Gannant is never alone, not even in her bathroom. Here she is one morning getting ready. She's got jazz on in the background, her hair is in curlers, and she's putting on her makeup.
Man, this mascara burns my eyes. Oh, man. Oh, my eye. I don't know what they put in this stuff.
And as mundane as this is, 36 people are watching Jody right now. If you were one of them, logged into her website, what you'd see is Jody on a small screen, and right next to it, a live chat, where her fans keep a running commentary on what she's up to. They post messages Jody can read, and she answers them.
Good morning, Muriel. How's everybody doing? Okay, good afternoon. Gotta be so technical.
Jody Gannant has been streaming her life on the internet 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, for the last 6 months. Well, except for 1 week in early January, but we'll get to that later. How she does it is she's attached a video camera to her laptop that she carries with her all the time. She broadcasts nearly everything she does, but she's not a total exhibitionist. Like, when she's in the shower, she points the camera at a painting to give her some privacy. She doesn't sleep on camera.
And people say, like, don't you find that creepy that there's people, like, waiting for you to wake up? And I honestly believe that they're there to wish me off for a good day.
Jody's 29 and was raised in Phoenix. After high school, she went to community college, but never graduated. She ended up working for an airline, taking reservations over the phone. But about 2 years ago, she quit her 9-to-5 to follow her dream of becoming a singer. Her viewers, and she has thousands who log in on any given day, even more on the weekends, might one day see her booking a gig, another day rehearsing. The last weekend of December, Jody had a concert in downtown Phoenix. She webcast that, too.
Hey, guys, thank you so much for braving the cold, turning down weekend New Year's parties to come out and jam with us. We really appreciate it. And I go to sleep with you on my mind. And I try to think of all the times we've had, but it's not enough to know.
Jody never meant to be online this long. It was supposed to be a little promotional stunt to drum up interest in her CD released in September. But September came, and she was having too much fun to quit. For some of her friends, though, it's not as fun. Roger Belfiore says it's definitely cut into her relationships. Because when you're with Jody, you're not just with Jody anymore. You're on the webcam.
Once you hang around her enough, you learn to adjust yourself because there's people around, other people are listening. So you don't say phone numbers and you don't say, profanity and stuff. And you try to respect what she's doing.
Jody says a few of her friends have dropped into the shadows and are waiting for the life cast to be over. It almost came to a screeching halt the first week of January. She went offline for a whole week.
Honestly, I didn't feel like being sick on camera.
Some of her online friends called her up to make sure she was okay. One of them was Tammy Nelson, who goes by the handle Seattle Girl. She's a stay-at-home mom and says for a while, she had Jody stream on in the house 24 hours a day.
We did a little pretend blood bonding on the chat one day. We both put a red pin on our fingers, and I touched my screen, and she touched her camera, and we consider ourselves best friends.
Another online friend is Matt Taylor, an IT specialist in rural Ohio.
I think it's a fascination with just the process of what she's going through. I mean, you can see the ups and downs of her career. You actually see what's going on as it's going on. It's not recorded. It's not edited. It's better than reality television.
Of course, simply by reporting this story on Jody, I also became part of the life cast. I met her at a club in downtown Phoenix, and she introduced me to her portable audience.
This is Renee, everyone. She's going to be doing the interview. Hello, people.
I waved awkwardly into the camera. The interview itself was a bit uncomfortable. I was self-conscious about having 75 people watching us online, and Jody kept obsessively checking the chat room. She calls her fans her kids.
They need constant attention, you know, and they do things on their own, don't get me wrong. They're, you know, adults in many cases and can suffice on their own, but they need constant...
You're kind of not really able to talk about them without looking down to keep looking at what they're saying and possibly commenting on your conversation right now.
They're saying, feed me!
Jody says she isn't life-casting to become a superstar and play to sold-out stadiums. She says she is trying to prove to the world that from the time she gets up to the time she goes to bed, music consumes her.
People have equated it to a hunger strike where, you know, I'm on the internet and I'm showing people what I'm doing and good, bad, ugly, and otherwise, like, they're just going to see that I'm not going to quit until maybe, well, no, I'm just not going to quit.
They're going to have to wrest the laptop from your cold, dead hand.
Not the laptop, but definitely the microphone. When I'm talking about this, I'm not exactly talking about the life cast. I'm talking about the life cast capturing and documenting the fact that all I'm trying to do here is make a living making music.
So many voices, we make our choices, and all of it comes at a cost. So
Jody's not making enough money from her music yet, but every month more and more people are logging into her livecast. She admits sometimes she misses her privacy and is tempted to shut off the laptop, but says she can't because she's no longer just in it for herself. She doesn't want to let her fans down either. So for now, there's no end in sight.
We're celebrating our 90th day and also 100,000 viewers. And I'd like to make a toast to new friends.
In Phoenix, I'm Renee Gattell for Weekend America.
Des, have you checked in with Jody today?
Yeah, I did, but she was still sleeping.
That's riveting.
Yesterday, though, I found myself checking in on her like I was her mom just to make sure she was okay. But I'm not sure what would keep me logging on to watch.
I actually kind of like the idea of life casting, of living transparently. But you heard her friend talk about learning how to behave around her camera, mm-hmm. which makes me wonder, if I streamed my life, would I really live transparently or would I just be, you know, behaving, performing my life?
Yeah, it's like that theory in quantum mechanics where just by watching you change the behavior of those subatomic particles. So I wonder if it's the same with people. Well, make physics and Jody your friends. Go to our website, weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, KPCC Los Angeles, and KUOW Seattle, and is made possible in part by the University of Washington Executive MPA Program.
Coming up, Stephen Colbert hanging in the National Portrait Gallery. It might be funny, but is it art? Stay tuned to Weekend America. From American Public Media, welcome to The Weekend. I'm Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper, and we're happy to be part of the soundtrack to your weekend. But let us say, theoretically, that you don't listen exclusively to public radio Friday evening through Sunday. If there is a song that you put on to sort of change your weekday frame of mind, a song that accompanies and perfects your weekend, then we want to hear from you. This segment is called Weekend Soundtrack. We've been hearing your stories and your music for months now. You can go to our website and hear all our weekend soundtracks. Today we meet a listener named Sue Ely. She listens to us in Juneau, Alaska, and her weekend soundtrack is Haunted House by Natalia Zuckerman.
Feel stupid. You made me feel ugly without even trying. You made me want you, but you made me feel nothing. Then you made me promise when you knew I was lying. And this is what you wanted. Well, this must be what you wanted. Like a wants to be haunted. Is this what you wanted?
Sue, I'm sensing hostility.
Really?
Tell us about this song and your weekends.
Well, I guess to me this song is about that place in lost love where you're still obviously really angry, but starting to accept that things are over and starting to sort of understand how that love failed.
This must be what you wanted, like a house wants to be haunted. What does that mean, Sue?
These haunted houses are everywhere, and when other people look at them, they just see all the problems, the shingles that are missing, the fact that the shutters have fallen off and the windows are cracked, and, you know, the vines are starting to creep up into everything. And I guess I sort of long for that point in my life where I feel that way about that lost love, that I look at it and say, it really is just a nasty old house that's falling down, and I don't have to miss it anymore. I'm afraid here, and the wind is starting to...
Sue, as long as this is your weekend soundtrack, are you really letting the house go?
I think that a good therapist would say no. Yeah. If you get real quiet, you can see some things as they used to be. And I see a house. It's got boarded up windows. It's got squeaky floorboards. I drive out the road when I take my dogs out on hikes, and I listen to the song as I go out there, and it helps me. And I sing it when I'm out there letting the bears know that I'm around.
Scaring away the bears.
Yes, if you've ever met an angsty girl in the woods, you'd know better than to bother her. This is what we wanted. Now
we're a house that's haunted, but that's what we wanted. We can be a little lighthearted about this, but how are you doing?
I'm doing good.
Yeah?
Yeah, I mean, I'm doing really well.
What stage are you in this old house?
Oh, I can still see it. Yeah. You can still see the way it used to be.
Still dwelling in your dwelling.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, all things take their own time.
Sue, thank you for sharing your weekend soundtrack with us.
Thank you so much, Bill.
Sue Ely in Juneau, Alaska. Her song was Haunted House by Natalia Zuckerman. What about you? What song is the soundtrack to your weekend, and what's the story behind it? Even more importantly, tell us your tale when you come see us at weekendamerica.org.
Mm-hmm.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
I'm Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper. This weekend in Washington, D.C., people will visit the Smithsonian's National Portrait Gallery to admire great Americans, and they'll see Stephen Colbert. The Comedy Central satirist is hanging just outside the Hall of Presidents over by the public bathrooms. It's a temporary exhibit that gets in on the joke of Colbert's self-important TV persona. But does it belong in the Smithsonian? Joining us now is the art critic for San Francisco Magazine, conceptual artist Jonathan Keats. He says the Colbert portrait is part of a long history of playful art that includes Marcel Duchamp calling a urinal art in 1917.
It seems to me apt that the Colbert portrait should be between the men's and women's room. The urinal of Marcel Duchamp came out of the restroom, and to bring this portrait right back in, or as close as you can get, is a way of bringing the humor full circle. It effectively not only brought into question what is art, but more generally, who are our icons? What is important to us? The National Portrait Gallery is seen as the epicenter of our most important figures, our heroes. And yet at the same time, it's almost a black box situation. We don't really see how things go into that museum or why they are there. And I think that for Colbert to go and to say to the administration, well, why can't I be in there too, is a very interesting way in which to open up the conversation. And not only that, it's a very interesting way once that conversation is open for us to ask whether the people who we typically think of as being significant really are so significant as those who we might otherwise denigrate, TV personalities or an actor playing a TV personality in the case of Colbert.
Jonathan, there are a lot of serious statements to be made. Why should art be playful?
Humor and art has the potential, I think, to make art accessible, to bring people into the conversation who otherwise wouldn't be. And this can be seen through the fact that so many people are coming to the National Portrait Gallery who never were going there before. And in essence, it puts them into the role of being able to play along, play not only within the realm of art, but also within the larger realm of American identity.
You've had a lot of fun in your work. You distributed a cell phone ringtone of John Cage's composition 433, which is 4.5 minutes of silence.
Well, it was actually a digital remix of that.
Oh, it was a remix.
Yes, and it was pure digital silence. Unfortunately, Cage didn't have the opportunity to work in pure silence. You used to have to go, in the case of John Cage, into a great big auditorium in order to be able to experience it. This is a way of taking it out of that context and spreading it throughout the world just as the world becomes more and more noisy.
So if I'm going to an art museum this weekend, how could I make my experience there more playful?
Taking nothing seriously, even work that takes itself seriously, and especially the labels on the wall that take the institution seriously, taking all that and tossing it out and looking at the work obtusely, looking at the work with utter and complete freedom to interpret it however you want, that that's the beginning of play, and that through that you can really make the museum your own, not only elevate the work because it will make the work meaningful, but also will elevate you in a way that you may never think because you thought that it was all just a joke.
Jonathan, it was a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much.
Likewise. Thank you very much for your time.
I'm going to play your John Cage ringtone during our next piece. Our listeners will be able to hear both at the same time.
Oh, good. I hope that it isn't too distracting.
Me too. Jonathan Keats is a conceptual artist and the art critic for San Francisco Magazine. You're listening to his ringtone right now. You can download it and find a link to a gallery of his work at weekendamerica.org.
All this month, we've been taking a look at winter. When the sun sets a little earlier and the air is so cold, sometimes you just can't help but hibernate. Musician Justin Vernon did just that last year. He'd been living in Raleigh, North Carolina, and he moved to a northern Wisconsin cabin by himself for the winter. When he emerged last February, he started recording the songs that he wrote while he was living alone with the snow. That winter had such an impact on him that it even influenced the project's name, Bon Iver.
Bon Iver is French for good winter. First time I ever heard Bon Iver really used in practice was I was watching a television show. I was very sick. I was in bed for 3 months, and I sort of dove into this television show, Northern Exposure. And there's this episode where the people in this tiny town in Alaska come out, and they hug each other, and they say Bon Iver, and they kind of like greet the winter like that. For me, growing up here in the Midwest, it was a sacred thing. A lot of people like run away from it or shy away from winter. It seemed very fitting to name the project after the winter that created the music.
This my excavation to...
I left North Carolina with a lot on my mind. I sort of broke up with my band. I broke up with a girlfriend. I went straight back to Wisconsin because I didn't have anywhere else to be, and I just knew I couldn't be in North Carolina anymore. I went straight to my dad's hunting lodge because it was the only place that I felt like I could be alone.
Everything that happens from now, this is...
I arrived at the cabin in November, so there was a very big winter theme for everything that I was there. Just on a physical level, I would have to wake up to stoke the fire or wake up to get wood chopped to get it in the house to keep warm. Just winter in general was kind of a part of where I was, and physically and metaphysically as well. And that just really, it bled into the music sort of naturally. I was about 25 miles from anything, even a gas station, and miles from any other home. So the only thing you'd hear really is like the slight howl from the highway 20 miles away, and then maybe birds. But really, it was just so quiet. I had nothing but the sort of sound of my own thoughts, and they were really loud when that's all that's going on. One of the songs I wrote when I was in the cabin was called For Emma. There's a lyric in there that says, I saw death on a sunny snow. And it was very typical for a day up there, like in February. I remember there was a day right before I left that it was like negative 20, but the sun was shining, and it's a brilliant sort of contrast. And the song, whenever I sing this song or perform this song, that's where I am. Sort of this repetitive thing that happens in the song. It's not as much about home, because I didn't know what home was at that point. That wasn't as established for me. My parents had a home, and I grew up at a home, but I was just running. These stories in this song all happen during the winter, because about February every year is when it gets really hard. I think the starkness and the grayness and the lack of sun, and when the dirt and the salt sort of build up at the side of the roads, I think it's about time for the ground to start thawing. And I think it's when people's hearts really start to give out. I think that's when you remember it the most. Thank you.
That's Justin Vernon, also known as Bon Iver. Glad his heart didn't give out. This weekend, he's rehearsing in Fall Creek, Wisconsin. He has an upcoming tour starting next month. Bill, you know, there's something so romantic about that idea of a winter retreat, but I'm just wondering how easy. I would find it hard to be completely alone with myself.
Yeah, I like to think, and I hope it would be cleansing and uplifting, but I don't know. If I'm feeling troubled to start with, as Justin was, and now I'm without loved ones or any distractions, would I be uplifted, or would I have nothing to lift me? I would just keep sinking.
Yeah, maybe that's a Western view, because other cultures seem to value retreat, meditation, silence. It's not as scary to them as it is to us. You can see Bon Iver performing his song. Just go to our website at weekendamerica.org.
Well, this weekend I'm at North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, Chapel Hill. It's going to be partly to mostly sunny today, up to the mid-40s. Here's John Moe's version of the weekend weather.
Anniston, Alabama has showers and 49 degrees, and everyone's running around half-naked. Well, sort of. The Anniston Runners Club Half-Naked Marathon is named because it's half the length of a marathon, and there are no awards or live support. Also, the name is good for drumming up interest. Do they give out those weird half-t-shirts if you finish? Learn curling, meet hockey players and Mounties, and indulge in all things north of the border in that great Canadian city of Phoenix, Arizona. It's the Great Canadian Picnic, held under a very un-Manitoba-like 65 degrees and showers. I think it's all part of a clever invasion plan. They capture Phoenix and fan out, or oat, from there. I'm on to you, Canada. Mardi Gras puts everyone in a mood for fun, the kind of mood dogs are in all the time. Thus, the Barkus Mardi Gras Parade, as canines are dressed up, paraded under showers in 65, and a king and queen are named. It's for charity and because dressing up dogs is funny. According to the information here, the idea was thought up in a bar. I know, hard to believe, right? For information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm John Moe for Weekend America.
For women too shy to shake it in public, have we got a party for you, coming up on Weekend America.
Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Online at calvert.com.
From American Public Media, welcome to the show that's all about the weekend. I'm Bill Radke at North Carolina Public Radio.
And I'm Desiree Cooper in St. Paul, Minnesota. There's a big difference between dancing in your underwear in the living room and going out to a nightclub. You're always free to party in your living room, but dancing alone can get boring. Finally, there's a way to bridge the gap. It's an event called Dance Dance Party Party. No rules, no men, just women dancing in the dark. The idea has spread to a dozen cities, and this Sunday, it's at a North Chicago studio. Reporter Ann Glickman takes us inside.
When I'm at a party, my dancing style's more spaz than swan. I hide my lack of coordination and self-confidence by getting ridiculous. I throw down the Billy Clinton, squeezing my eyes shut and pretending to play the sax. I bust out a move I call the point, where I stand with my hip cocked to one side and point with powerful conviction to different parts of my anatomy. I'm good at getting a laugh, but I still worry about what people might think if I just drop the act and dance like a maniac. So when I heard about Dance Dance Party Party, I thought it might be my turn to get my groove back. Chicago chapter co-founder Jennifer Brandel lured me with talk of a judgment-free dance party meets unstructured exercise class.
I think most classes start with the premise that there's something wrong that we're trying to fix here, and there's a goal in mind, there are certain steps you have to take to reach that goal, and we're going to be watching you, and you're going to be watching yourself, and basically, don't screw up. Ours, that premise is nowhere to be found. The premise is, you are awesome, we are all awesome, let's be awesome together.
I arrive at a small studio in northwest Chicago and join 20 or so other awesome ladies wearing eclectic exercise clothes and running shoes. There's no men allowed, but that didn't make me feel any more at ease. I find women judge each other at least as harshly as men do. And other dancers, like Jennifer Grace Schwarz, feel the same way.
I've thought about telling my friends about this, but I'm a little possessive because I don't really want to worry about what they think about what I'm doing. So this is kind of my thing where I come and the people I know, I only know through here, and it's safe. It's cool.
It's kind of like not wanting to share your shrink.
I wouldn't know about that.
Unfortunately, I would. I can be a touch neurotic, and this is no exception. I'm standing by the wall of the studio. My arms are crossed under my expanded breasts. My eyes are unsure of where to focus. Most of the others are standing as awkwardly as I am. It feels like we're about to have a grade school scoliosis check. Then the lights snap off and the ride begins. The music's funky, but we're not. Women start to shift back and forth in place, but no one's breaking loose. I instinctively crack out my Billy Clinton, but it feels totally forced, and it's just plain stupid to do in the dark. I'm dancing without a script and coming up short. I'm ashamed of all my dancing bravado. I feel a bit like the kid at the slumber party who wants to call her parents and go home before she's even unfurled her sleeping bag. Then Rock Lobster comes on and everything changes. My inner 10-year-old wakes up from a long nap, and I remember that the whole point is to simply do my thing. Right then, two ladies start leaping into the air. It feels like seeing a twin comet. Something shakes loose inside, and I start jumping along with them. Then, as if some unspoken communication has passed between us, all the women in the room begin slowly slinking down to the floor. We roll over onto our backs, our arms and legs jutting out to the heavens. We're shaking and unfurling like a cluster of overturned ladybugs. We've hit maximum dance absurdity, and I feel ecstatic. The rest of the class is a blur. I stomp about like a drunken green giant to cheesy 80s hits. I see a woman crab walking to the beat of this Go-Go's classic. One gal gets down on it by madly darting from one corner of the room to the other like a pinball on crack. Class ends and endorphins are running high.
Okay, I'm asking people for one word they feel after class.
Exhilaration.
Happy.
Energized.
Uplifted.
Refreshed.
Fantastic.
I've silenced my self-doubt and instinct to please. That said, I'm still not quite ready to retire my hip-thrusting pointing shtick from my repertoire. It really is quite a showstopper. In Chicago, I'm Ann Glickman for Weekend America.
You can see lots of pictures of the Chicago ladies getting jiggy with it on our website, weekendamerica.org. You know, Bill, there's a subtext here, and that's making women feel safe to move about the planet. Like, a lot of women don't like to go to bars or clubs, so this is probably a more welcoming alternative for them. I notice that hotels are assigning women-only floors to female business travelers, and there's even some women-only cruises for the same reason.
Right. You know, I just heard about a new exercise trend I must pass on. I'm at North Carolina Public Radio this week, and there is a little hula hoop fad here, especially in a wholesome little town called Carrboro. Hmm. And I met a couple who just got back from New York and Chicago teaching instructors how to conduct hula hoop classes to music. So that's the next big thing.
Well, it's always fun to just move about freely, especially when you're in a big group. Like even at a live concert where everyone's on their feet, they're just having a great time and moving around. I'll bet you remember something special about a live performance that you've attended. We want to hear your stories. Did something memorable happen at a concert that you just went to?
You got backstage and met your idol. Maybe something happened there that actually made you wish you had stayed home. If you have an unforgettable concert story, then we'd love to hear it. Tell us your story when you come to our website, weekendamerica.org. Well, that does it for this hour of American Public Media's Weekend America. I'm Bill Radke. I want to thank my hosts at North Carolina Public Radio. I'm having a lovely weekend here.
And I'm Desiree Cooper. You can download a free podcast of the entire program at weekendamerica.org. Hey, get out there and enjoy your weekend.
Go hula hooping.
News and financial information brought to you by Reuters, the world's news and information source, working to make a difference every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul, and made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by
American Public Media.
What does it take to be number one? Well, first you need the highest rated TV show in the world. Check, that's this weekend, the Super Bowl. Next,
we originally raised $7 million and about $3.2 million was going to Super Bowl.
Remembering the day $3 million bought a page in the Super Bowl history book and for one brief moment made two guys the most popular men in the country. On the next Weekend America.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.